From the Jesuits of Canada and the United States, this is AMDG, and I'm Eric Clayton. You might be familiar with the American Catholic novelist Flannery O'Connor. You might have read her short stories in a class, maybe A Good Man is Hard to Find or Everything That Rises Must Converge, to name a few. You might have even read one of her novels, an essay or two, or some of her letters. You might know that she spent much of her relatively short life in Georgia. And if you know her work well, then you also know that she died in 1964. And so, you might be really surprised to learn that she published her third novel, Why Do the Heathen Rage, earlier this year. Well, to be clear, the renowned O'Connor scholar and Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University, and today's guest, Dr. Jessica Houghton-Wilson, did. Dr. Wilson has been working on this incredible project, uncovering O'Connor's notes and drafts for many, many years now. And the final result is quite stunning. While the book isn't really a full and final novel, O'Connor died before she could finish it, what Jessica Houghton-Wilson gives us is a literary excavation of Flannery's life, legacy, and the story that might have been. Now, if you are familiar with O'Connor, you likely are also familiar with the recent discourse about her thoughts and writing on race. Dr. Wilson does not shy away from addressing this sordid legacy head-on. In reflecting on this final unfinished novel, Dr. Wilson notes that we really see Flannery coming up against her own limitations in understanding race in the American South. And yet we also see her struggling to reconcile the clear racism of her day with the call of her own Catholic faith. It's not an easy conversation, but Dr. Wilson walks us through with care and grace. Now, if you are interested in learning more about her work, visit jessicahoutonwilson.com. And be sure to pick up your copy of Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress, now available from Brazos Press. And now, here's Jessica Houghton-Wilson. Jessica Houghton-Wilson, welcome back to AMDG. We're so glad you're with us today.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, and well, you have this excellent, excellent new work. Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress, which is just out, right, from Brazos Press. And it's so cool. I just briefly, give us, like, tell us just the elevator pitch. What is this project? And then we'll kind of dive deep, because I loved it.
Well, thank you. Flannery O'Connor died in 1964, and she was in the middle of writing a third novel. And I did not find this out until 2009. And when I found out, I was like, whoa, people have to see this. They have to know what she was working on. So I've actually spent the last 14 years or so trying to make sure people could see, what was this third novel? How is this writer that we absolutely loved continuing? What was she working on? What was she in progress of doing? And so what I've done is kind of this literary excavation of the pages that she left behind, and hopefully giving us more to understand about the writer herself, but also more to understand about the work that's still incomplete.
And you do just a great job of weaving in this, the kind of the fiction, within this deep insight into who she was and the context of how, where she was existing, which I think really pairs well as you progress through the book. But before we dive in to the book, you paint a really vivid scene, I think, of a dinner, right, when you discovered that you were that there was this unfinished work. So I wonder if you can just kind of drop us into that scene and help us kind of feel that excitement. And what were you thinking? Did you ever think you'd be the one to tackle this?
Oh, yeah. So this was, I had just finished my dissertation under Ralph Wood at Baylor University in Waco, and I was obsessed with Dostoevskian influences on Flannery O'Connor, which O'Connor was steeped in. She was reading Dostoevsky at the end of her life again for another time. That's what she was choosing to read. And I was privileged enough to go to the Flannery O'Connor First International Conference that was being hosted in Rome at the time. I had lived in Florence when I was a student, an undergrad, and so I had some familiarity with the language and some familiarity with the city. And somehow I got voluntold that I was taking all of the keynote speakers to dinner because they didn't know where to go, and I did know where to go. So I'm walking all of these amazing keynotes, and I'm a grad student. Nobody knows who I am in this group. and we're going to dinner together. And I just remember at first, I'm just like a fly on the wall. I'm just watching all of them discuss O'Connor and share their stories. And most of them have known each other for a long time. These are like seasoned professors. And there's a biographer of O'Connor that was actually her friend, Billy Sessions, was at the table. And wow. As Billy's talking, he starts asking me who I am and what I'm working on. And I said, Dostoevsky's influence on O'Connor. And he said, well, her most Dostoevskian work was her final novel. And I was like, The Violet Bared Away? He's like, no, the one she was working on when she died, Why Did the Heathen Rage? And I just remember, I mean, my jaw must have hit the table. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I was stunned that there was something else and that nobody had discussed it. Nobody even mentioned that she was working on a novel when she died. Everyone knows that she was working on Revelation, Parker's Back. But when people tell the story of Flannery, they barely mentioned that she was working on a third novel. And so I went to investigate, and I think that investigation just became very fruitful. But it's definitely, it needs to be a full story of Flannery. I think forgetting her third novel is misunderstanding her work altogether.
And I think, you know, especially when you're looking at a person like Flannery O'Connor, like understanding, like what they're working on and where their mind was going and where it is so important. And so, yeah, it is crazy that this third piece was left off the biographical details. I know you have a really cool kind of origin story with Flannery O'Connor that I would love for you to tell for our listeners. Where did you first discover Flannery, and why did she so kind of move you as a writer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how most people come by Flannery. I would assume that they now come by Flannery in like a first year intro class in college or something along those lines. But for me, I was 15. I was in a talented and gifted program at Rhodes College during the summer, and I was trying to be a novelist. And at 15, I was struggling with this tension between my Christian faith and the way that my parents taught me to see the sunny side of things, to live into the resurrection story, to focus on the good. You know, we didn't have crucifix on our wall. We didn't have Jesus hanging there. Everything was about the stone has been rolled away. And so how do you write stories where you're telling that truth? But also, I myself was a 15-year-old drawn to darkness, feeling anxiety, feeling loneliness, you know, feeling sinfulness, all the things that I think teenagers are feeling, and trying to write both things truthfully, I was struggling with. And so I was either sanitizing or pretending that darkness didn't exist, or from my parents' perspective, I was uplifting the darkness, right, as darkness. And a professor there gave me my first Flannery O'Connor story. He said, you know, if you're Christian and you are drawn to the darkness, you should read this work. And it was the best introduction to Flannery possible. So I read The Life You Save May Be Your Own, and it just completely opened my eyes. Here is a woman who knew how to stare into the darkness in order to show the light. And that kind of paradox was transformative for me. I imitated her story. I mean, I would say very heavily imitated her story by writing my own version of it when I was 15. And then I won this national story contest. And, you know, they flew us out to DC, my whole family. And I was at the Kennedy Center, and Hillary Clinton gave the award, you know, like Molly Shannon was the MC. And so it was just like this whole big deal when I was a teenager. Then I thought, this is the secret to life. Like, this is what you do, is you imitate Flannery O'Connor and your life is going to go well. And, you know, that really has stuck with me. That's what I found myself doing for, you know, the last 25 years or so.
Well, and then now you have this, you had this opportunity, you've successfully kind of executed on it to tackle this final work. And I mean, just as I was reading it, you know, as someone who likes to write, I was just fascinated by the process you went through. Obviously you do creative writing, but mostly you're doing a lot of academic and scholarly work and research. But you have a lot of, you've done a little bit of fiction writing to complete the story here. So can you just kind of give us a sense of how did you tackle this project? What went into it? You've already said you spent some research, certainly, but how do you go about, how do you approach finishing the story of a much beloved novelist?
Yeah, you know, first was the scholarly approach, which was necessary. Just transcribing everything took 2 or 3 years just to get through the 378 pages, because you have limited time in the archives that you can actually type every single word and write every single page, because you can't take it with you. You know, it's not like something you can carry around. So that took a lot of time. And then just getting a sense of her biography, you know, like making the big storyboard where it's like, here's the timeline of her life and the major events. And then I was making index cards, like putting them up on that board, like what books are coming out during that time? what films are coming out during that time? Who else is writing? Who is she friends with? Where is she traveling to? And just kind of putting everything out there. So I just dove so deep into who Flannery was, how she was living life, and what she was reading and taking in culturally. And as I went through that process and did this really more academic textual criticism of the work, I thought nobody but academics are going to want this. And Flannery never wrote for academics. I mean, she constantly kind of makes fun of academics in her letters. And not even kind of. She makes fun of academics in her letters because she didn't like the idea of pretension when it comes to your intellect. The intellect is to be used to share these kind of goods. The genius is going to give us stories that we can actually enjoy. So how could I tell a story for Flannery? Well, I also tried the presumption of finishing her novel. And FSG even read it, which is like my only encounter with FSG because they're amazing. And I was lucky enough to like get to even send them anything.
And what is FSG, just for our listeners?
Oh, sorry. Ferris, Strauss & Giroux, which is Flannery's publisher. So they have first right of refusal for everything that comes out Flannery, from Flannery's side. And they know Flannery's work so well. But what I was doing was Jessica Houghton Wilson's fan fiction of Flannery at the end of the day. And it was not worth publishing as Flannery. And so then that led to the third project, this iteration that has actually come out, which was an idea from another really successful writer, Harrison Scott Key. So any of your listeners who do not know him should look him up. He's amazing. He's written 3 books. He's a nonfiction writer. And he and I were talking about this project. And he's like, you know what you need to do is the story is you writing this, telling how she was working on this. It's like all of it coming together. It needs to be this amazing literary experiment. And I think he was right. And giving me that option to kind of put all these pieces together, you know, a little bit of my creative writing, my scholarship, but also being able to tell a story in a way that readers could be involved, that readers could help finish this process. He was right on about that. And so that's the method that I took finally to get out this book.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. As someone who likes good writing and kind of literature, it is I think it's a good introduction to folks just interested in what literary excavation might be, because I didn't even know that was a term until I was telling someone I was reading this book, and they're like, oh, that sounds like it, and it just I was like, oh yeah, it sounds great. And just the process of here's a story, here's what's happening in real time, here's what's happening in the author's life, and not all good. Like, you're not putting her up on this pedestal. I think you're very you're very real in approaching this person in the time and place in which she is, through also from the lens of today, 2023, when it was published, 2024, which I think is really helpful. But we'll get more into that. I want to talk about the story itself, because it's not complete.
Right.
So how would you summarize the story for folks, and kind of how does it fit into O'Connor's kind of canon, if we might use that word?
Yeah, I think what we can summarize is the premise of the novel, because that's really what we get. And so I want to make sure to not up people's expectations too much for what's actually there. But the premise of the novel is that Flannery, it starts with what we are used to with Flannery. We have a Southern white home. We have, this time we have both living parents. That's actually kind of rare, but one of them has a stroke. So again, she kind of always takes the dad out of the picture in her stories. And so you have the overbearing farm working mom. You have the intellectual child. So the main character is Walter, and Walter Tillman is in the same tradition as Julian from Everything Rises Must Converge, or Asbury from The Enduring Chill. And so you have these same kinds of intellectual stay-at-home kids, right? Very much like Flannery herself, going off to school and then coming home and staying on the farm. So that's how it starts. You think that that's the same formula. And then what she changes, which she has not done before, she has Walter become a correspondent with a New York civil rights activist named Una Gibbs. And in this correspondence, this is a habit of Walter's. He writes to people pretending to be someone else. So you can imagine, Twitter trolls. This is what he does for his, kicks, is he feels so intellectually superior to everyone that he writes letters condescending other people, pretending to be other people in order to make fun of other people's worldviews and beliefs. But as he starts testing Una's beliefs, he realizes the only way to really test her is to fall in love through the mail, but he himself is pretending to be Black. And he knows, right? He thinks this white woman in New York could never actually love a black man. So he's trying to test her very claims about love and how much she can actually love him. So he puts on what I call epistolary blackface. And this isn't out of the blue. I mean, this was happening, actually. James Howard Griffin had written a book, bestseller book called Black Like Me, in which you have a guy from the Northeast who is putting on blackface and going and living in the South, pretending to be black as though just putting on blackface is going
right.
to have the black experience. You know, so this is common. This is not just Flannery. She's actually testing culture to see, like, can we do this? Is this is someone putting on blackface in the South really the black experience? And she's kind of wrestling with these things herself. So in Flannery's canon, as you mentioned, we don't have her really addressing race this solidly, except maybe things like Revelation and Everything Rises Must Converge. And when we put those works in context with this novel, we see that she was almost like starting this trajectory where she was looking at the contemporary headlines around her and digging underneath the surface of them to find how to talk about the eternal problems of how we're loving each other and how we love a neighbor and where's the Imago Dei and some of these eternal questions that were always important to O'Connor. She's actually turning her attention to race in order to answer those questions. This is some of the first time in her work, right? This hasn't been a common theme in her work.
Yeah. I wonder if we could kind of dig more into that. Because I think recently, right, in the last couple of years, Flannery O'Connor's, letters or writing on race or race relations has come under a deal of scrutiny. And certainly I think listeners, hearing kind of, black faces as part of the plot is kind of rightly going to make people, put people off. So I wonder if I think you did a really nice job treating that in your book of Flannery's kind of her recognition of her own limitations as far as race relations goes. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how you think about some of the discourse kind of in the air right now around Flannery O'Connor and race?
Yeah, I think this is really important. And you have to remember this is coming out in 2024, but I was working on this between 2010 and 2021, essentially. So I finished everything in 2021. So I'm in the middle of working on this novel that nobody knows about in 2020, when we have Black Lives Matter kind of like the height of things and people are finally maybe paying attention and Flannery O'Connor's How Racist is Flannery O'Connor? The piece comes out with Paul Ely and he exposes some of the letters that had finally been allowed to be published in which Flannery says a lot of racist things. Mm-hmm. And so this comes to the forefront of the conversation. And so I've been trying to address what I think needs a lot more nuance and a lot longer conversation than trying to have incendiary headlines and or trigger warnings. Like either direction to me is not being truthful to what Flannery was doing. So when we think of something like blackface, this is not like a really bad movie like Holiday Inn in which a character gets up there and puts blackface on and dances around and everybody's okay with it. And this is for entertainment and it's exploiting black experience. No, Flannery sees that somebody has made a best-selling work about someone putting on blackface, and she's actually putting that under her microscope. Like she's testing what is going on in culture, and she's trying to deal with her segregated world where this was normalized, where people did not try to understand the black experience. Her mother did not have, black friends come over for tea. They did not go out to lunch with black friends. This is just a very segregated white world that Flannery is living in. And she's testing that experience with her cognitive assertions that we're all made in the image of God, that we all belong to the same church, that we belong to the same mystical body of Christ. So she's trying to wrestle with that tension of her lived experience versus the ideals of heaven, right? And I think that that's what we see in this work that she does so well is saying, okay, I cognitively assent to the things that scripture and the tradition and the church has taught me, and my lived experience does not. I'm in a body politic that does not assert the same things. And her fiction is reaching higher than her human limitations or her own experience is allowing her to practice, if that makes sense. And so she is moving that direction, but she dies a month after LBJ signs the Civil Rights Act. She does not enter into then an integrated world in any sense where she would have practiced that going forward.
it sounds too, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting, but that there is a working out of, like she's trying to do the working it out in her writing, much in the way that I feel like some people today might on social media kind of work out thoughts, and then something goes amiss, right, and they get hammered for it. Is that fair? Should we look at some of these? And I think that's one of the things I like about this book, is because you bring the fiction into dialogue with the history, and the biography, is that there, you can see the working out of it, and then you can see the context. Is that how we should approach this text, certainly, but her work in general? Is that a fair way to do it?
I think so. And if I could say a couple of things about that, one's personal and one's scholarly, or like as a teacher. So on the personal level, I like to compare this to how my husband and I have started thinking about women in ministry. And I know it's different in the Catholic settings, but if I think about a woman preaching, for example, I'm in the Protestant tradition, and that's something that my husband and I have moved to embrace women preachers. And then the more we embrace it, we start seeing in history that this is a reality and that women were preaching. But when we first started looking at this issue, we were both raised in traditions in which women are silent. I mean, silent in church. Like, I got in trouble if I sang louder than the man next to me, right? So I come from a tradition in which that was my reality. That's what I was habitualized to believe and understand and practice. So as I cognitively started to assent to women being allowed to speak from the pulpit and give sermons, my husband found it emotionally problematic when he tried to experience it. So he could cognitively say, like, yeah, I think that that's true. But then the experience of it was problematic. And I think this is what we see in Flannery. There was these cognitive assertions versus the practices that were really difficult for her, because she had been habitualized really in a world in which Black people were not treated well. I mean, that's such an understatement. Lynching, death, violence. Like, she is in that world in which people think that that's okay. And the white people around her are doing nothing about it. And that's a problem. And I think we see that as a problem. We should recognize that as a problem. On a teacher's standpoint, what I try to talk about with my students is, if we throw out every writer who was a sinner, so we don't excuse their sin, we acknowledge their sin. We acknowledge that Dostoevsky is an anti-Semite. That was horrible. But I'm not throwing out the Brothers Karamazov. I'm going to look down on him when he calls Jews yids, or when he like makes fun of Jewish culture. I'm not going to embrace those things that I know are not true to who the gospel calls me to be and what the gospel calls me to think. But the parts where Dostoevsky talks about forgiveness, where he shows me what active love versus imaginary love, what that looks like, those are the things I'm going to take. And I think we have to treat Flannery the same way. We are not going to uplift anything that smacks of racism. We're not going to excuse her. We're not going to say, well, it's okay, she's a product of her time. We're going to say, no, those are evils. Those are bad things that were around her that she was practicing. And then we're going to acknowledge that, like, probably right now, I am participating in cultural sins that I haven't even understood yet, that I am blind to myself, and that I'm going to be judged by if people are going to continue to move forward in sanctification beyond me, if my children know more than I know at this time. And I'm not going to put that same judgment on Flannery going backwards.
Yeah. And I think it's a great exercise of humility, I think, right, in our own personal and professional lives. And even, you know, what you said at the beginning, one of the things that drew you to Flannery in the first place was this idea of descent into darkness. But through that darkness, you can see something more clearly, right? There's some sort of light. And I think even in, you know, that's the fiction, but I think even in our own lives, right, our own grappling with just, you know, lived reality every day, you know, hopefully we get better and better at it as we go. And that's where the light emerges. I think one of the critiques of Flannery, in some circles, is that she's kind of held up as like, this is the, at least in the Catholic circles, this is the Catholic author to look at. And I know you teach at Pepperdine University. You teach on the great books and literature in general, right? And so I'm wondering what other authors do you present to students in conversation with Flannery? Because I think, yeah, she's an important author, and there were other ones then, right? Then and now. So how, when you're teaching Flannery O'Connor, what other writers or people are your students being introduced to?
Well, in that sense, it depends on the course too, because so in my current class, I'm teaching great books. So I'm teaching everything from Kierkegaard, and then I end with Flannery O'Connor. So I'm teaching Flannery O'Connor's stories in conversation with Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, which was a big influence on her, Dostoevsky, T.S. Eliot, right? We're having this conversation in which all of these writers are participating in these enduring questions, really big questions. And I think Flannery fits in that larger tradition, that human conversation. I've also taught, you know, both at St. Thomas in Houston and St. Thomas in Minnesota, Flannery is a Catholic writer. And what other writers have I looked at? So when I've looked at her in a Catholic novel course, in which we're studying Catholic literature, I'm putting her in conversation with J.F. Powers, with Graham Greene, with Evelyn Waugh, people she was actually in correspondence somewhat with, right? Even indirectly. And putting her work into those kind of conversations, how were they taking their Catholic faith and writing literature? Because it's not in the same vein. Those are very different styles. Like when you look at what Evelyn Waugh does compared to what Flannery O'Connor does, you wouldn't think that they're both Catholic. Yeah, right? I mean, they're completely different because of, you know, the British reservation there that he has, and then kind of like the epic British stories that looks very much more like Dickens or Austen or something, rather than Flannery's stark Johnny Cash style of writing short stories, you know? And so there's a lot that has to do with their particularities of time and place that affects the work that comes out, in addition to being able to ask those Catholic questions of, how is this a sacramental work? How is this a work which engages reality and assumes that there's an enchanted world that we're part of, that there's more going on here than what is on the surface level? And I think that's what we can do with any fiction that's like Cormac McCarthy or O'Connor, that we can't always do with contemporary novels, and especially Protestant novels.
I love that word enchanted. I think that's I'm more of a fantasy kind of guy, and so the enchanted is like very literal fairies and magic. But I think that's really sums up kind of the Catholic imagination really well. Let's go back to the story itself, and I'm wondering if for you as a reader, was there a scene or a character that really spoke to you in a kind of a meaningful way?
Yeah, you know, when I was reading Walter's Conversion, that's when I decided to publish this. You know, Billy Sessions had already kind of tapped me a few times and been like, we need to publish this. You know, this needs to get out there. But it was when I was reading Walter Tillman sitting on a rock, reading a letter in which Una Gibbs is just expressing her kind of new age. I've broken through the ceiling of religion. I've discovered we're all connected. You know, lightning has struck from within me. And he's like, lightning does not originate in the person. She's abrogated the place of God. Wait a second. I don't believe in God. Wait, I can't counteract her. Like, I can't refute her unless I believe in God. That's the only way that I can write back to this woman. And this moment of just sitting in on this rock, and he just says, good God in hell. You know, like there's this just very Flannery moment of revelation of like, Wait a second. And I, you know, I've had a similar moment. This is not just a fake. To me, fiction is best when it tells the truth about something and then helps me understand my own experience. And so, you know, I was teaching Nietzsche in class, and students are coming up against the fact that like a lot of them don't believe in God, but that means they can't believe in morality. And that revelation is like, wait, what? Yeah, if there's no God, what makes this good and this evil? Without God. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And that kind of moment for them is the same moment that Walter has on that rock where he's like, well, I can't refute this woman who set herself up as God. She can be God. She can be God in a godless universe. Why not? Ah, you know, it's just, and so that moment to me was just, I wanted to make sure other people saw that. I thought she wrote that so well.
Talk to us a little bit about what O'Connor is going through kind of at this point in her life. Like, what's the glimpse into the biography that listeners should know before they become readers?
Yeah, you know, scholars disagree on when she was writing this. Let me tell you what I think.
Yeah, I mean, you are the scholar, so.
but there's, you know, people have written on this text before, and they think that she worked on it a lot longer than she did. I don't think she started on it until around 1962. I think she had the ideas for it in the 1960s. And she's kind of writing some letters, like thinking through some ways of using Asbury, which she was writing The Endured Chill, like ways of using him in the future that she might want to play with. But I think she sat down to start writing this in the fall of 62, which means she works on it like less than 2 years, right? 18 months at most. So it had just barely gotten started. So what's happening for her are huge changes. You have JFK assassinated on television in her living room, which completely changes Flannery. I mean, she writes at that point, seeing that, I'm going to have to write different fiction than I've written before. If people are watching someone die in their living room on their own television, my kind of work where I shoot the grandmother, right, from the 1950s, this doesn't work anymore. The shock value is not going to be what drives people towards the faith anymore. So she kind of has this big transition that occurs because of television, because of the JFK assassination. Martin Luther King Jr. on her television screen, she starts writing letters about, like, I can actually respect him. I admire him. I, you know, she's listening to what he says in a way that news stories hadn't really captured her attention to the African-American plight in the South. And but seeing him on TV was different. So there's these, some of these big transitions that are happening as she's working on this novel and the things that she's reading. You know, she has friends who are going to Koinonia, which was America's Georgia. It's so close to Milledgeville. And they're going there, and there's, you know, the interracial fellowship, and they are having, they're working on a farm together, and it's an integrated community. And Dorothy Day even takes a Greyhound bus all the way down in order to help keep watch, because they're literally, people are shooting at Koinonia because of the way that they've set it up, this integrated community. And Flannery's paying attention to these things. So there's lots of changes in her imagination from the things that were going on around her.
Yeah, that's helpful to, I mean, to think about, because, you know, again, like, not that social media is new, but that change in technology that brings, that makes something more present and less, unfortunately, less shocking, and is important to keep in mind. Speaking of visuals, you have a lot of really powerful visuals, illustrations throughout the book. Tell us about those.
Sure. Well, and actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking about this when Steve Prince, who I invited to illustrate the book, so I first met Steve at Duke's 10th anniversary for Theology and the Arts, and he had done this amazing presentation. And the reason that I had been drawn to him was my dissertation director, someone who was on my dissertation was there, 80 years old, David L. Jeffrey, and he was like crying watching Steve Prince give this presentation about his art. And I thought, whoa, like this man is transformative. The way that he does art is moving people. It's changing people. So when I was working on Flannery, I started thinking about how Benny Andrews illustrated Flannery's Everything Rises Must Converge, and how having an African-American artist converse through art with the fiction was a way of glossing the fiction that was very medieval. It was what Flannery herself was always trying to be, kind of a medieval author in the 20th century, right? Retelling Bible stories in a way that made them feel new and fresh and defamiliarized. And then for Benny Andrews to illustrate her work that way was the same kind of thing I wanted to do with mine. How can we help complete the story where it's not just a white woman and a white woman writing, but also how can I have the African-American experience that Flannery doesn't understand fully drawn into the conversation, to show that, like, if this work is actually going to do some good, we have to have this conversation. It has to be a fuller picture than Flannery was able to do at the time of her death. And so my friend Steve does such a great job showing things in her work that I hadn't even seen by the way that he draws her fragments. One in particular that was standing out based on what I just said about television. He shows this moment where Walter is a young boy sitting at a table, and most of the picture is actually a newspaper. And the centerpiece of the newspaper, this would have been a white Southern newspaper, is so-and-so won the 4-H club's, you know, pig contest.
Yeah, it's like a pig, right? Yeah.
Right, yeah. It's a giant pig. And, you know, Walter's bored out of his mind because he's listening to his dad talk about, why can't you be so, you know, great like the boy next door who won this pig contest? And what you see is, like, around that image is the story of the four girls that were killed in Alabama. But it's downplayed. Mm-hmm. It's on the margins of the main story happening, which is about the neighbor kid winning a pig contest. And I think Steve did such a good job about showing that. You know, we know that Flannery had access to the suffering, to recognizing the suffering that was happening to her neighbors, but it just wasn't in the middle. It was marginalized. It wasn't seen. And so for Steve to put this in the center of the page and show us the marginalization that was occurring, that she herself was blind to and doesn't highlight in her own work, I think is a beautiful way of trying to understand the conversation. the things that we're missing, and hopefully the things that we now see. And if we do see, how do we write fiction different than Flannery? How can Flannery move us forward? And then we go beyond that. And that's what I think this art does. If people bought the book for no other reason than to have six prints by Steve Prince, to me, that would be an investment in good art, right? So that's what I tried to do when I designed the book. And that was something that I myself hired for and brought into the book.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I like what you said, and I like what that image reveals as you describe this idea that because it's true for all of us, right? We all have access to that suffering of others, but is it front and center in our lives? And how do we, what do we see in the center, and what do we see on the sides? And I think that's a helpful question. Jessica, if folks want to, and they do after hearing this interview, if they want to get your book, where should they go?
Yeah, one of my favorite booksellers is Eighth Day Books. So I would recommend going that direction, or bookshop. I love a lot of the kind of access to the local books. I miss my local bookstores. I'm in Malibu right now, and so we have a local bookstore, which is great. But for the most part, I think people should try to aim at Eighth Day Books. They're doing really good work. So
you traded bookstores for the ocean, huh?
Yeah, I did. I miss the little, especially the used books. I missed used bookstores so badly.
Well, I mean, maybe you can start one. You can just, I'm sure you have some used books. Any other projects that you got in the works right now that folks might want to know about?
Yeah. I'm working on a project on women right now. So I'm looking at the lives of Dorothy L. Sayers and Edith Stein and Anna Julia Cooper and what they have to tell us about women from the 20th century, female wisdom.
Very cool. Well, when that book is done, you come back on to AMDG and tell us all about it.
Be awesome.
Jessica, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
AMDG is a production of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States, and recorded at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. This episode was edited by me, Eric Clayton. Our theme music is by Kevin Lasky. The Jesuit Conference Communications team is Mike Lasky, Marcus Bleach, Megan Leipsch, Becky Sindelar, Kristen Smith, and me, Eric Clayton. Connect with the Jesuits at jesuits.org and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Get our weekly email reflection series, Now Discern This, by visiting jesuits.org/weekly. If you or someone you know would like to learn more about becoming a Jesuit or Jesuit life in general, connect with your local vocation promoter at beajesuit.org. Drop us an email with questions or comments at media@jesuits.org. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, as St. Ignatius may or may not have said, go and set the world on fire.